ABC Listen.
Tonight's guest on the playlist is Eric Bibb, a modern legend of the blues scene. He's been on that scene for more than five decades. He's scored three Grammy nominations, made more than 40 albums and secured a multitude of awards. He'll be touring Australia in May and June, including an appearance at the Blues on Broadbeach Festival on the Gold Coast on May 17 and 18. His newest album is a live recording at the Scala Theatre in Stockholm. It was recorded in 2022. This album is hot off the presses. Now, Eric grew up in New York City in the 50s and 60s, surrounded by music and musicians, including his father, Leon, who was a folk musician, his uncle, jazz pianist John Lewis. I understand Bob Dylan even once gave him advice on how to approach guitar playing. Today, Eric lives in Sweden, and tonight he's bringing you a playlist of the songs that influenced him most ahead of arriving in Australia mid-May. Hello, Eric. Welcome to the playlist on Nightlife.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you, Suzanne. Yeah.
So tell me, I mean, you grew up surrounded by music. Do you have a memory of really hearing it and listening to it for the first time?
Dad's voice is probably the first voice that really kind of printed, you know, in terms of being aware of music as such. He used to rehearse in the living room at home. So his guitarist would come over, and I'd be in bed with my twin sister, and we'd be pretending to be asleep, but basically listening in on my dad's rehearsal. So I heard guitars early on, very close up, fine guitar players, and my dad's beautiful voice, rehearsing material that was also to be found on their record collection, my parents' wonderful record collection. So, yeah, I was completely surrounded by music from a very early age.
Now, is it true that you, at one point, you were skipping school in order to just stay home and play records to yourself all day?
Absolutely. I would pretend that I had a sore throat. That was the two kind of excuse. And everybody would eventually leave the house, come downstairs and start taking out LPs from the collection that I wanted to really get into. And I would even make little marks on the record covers about which songs I thought I really needed to learn myself. You know?
So how old were you when you were doing that?
9, 10.
And so on. So there you are, pretending to be sick at home, 10-year-old Eric Bibb. What's on the playlist on an average day like that?
Oh, one of my big heroes, is Odetta, a contemporary of my dad's, a folk singing legend at that point. There were so many people who I listened to, but Judy Collins was another favorite of mine. Listen to a lot of the older records that my dad had. We're talking about Woody Guthrie and Lead Belly kind of things. I was at Joan Baez was also somebody I was listening to. I wanted to imitate the self-accompanying, you know, troubadours, the singers who played guitar or banjo and basically accompanied themselves. I thought that that was the pinnacle, to be able to your own music and sing your own song and something across was just, yeah, that was the goal.
So, I mean, it's the 60s. Were you actually living in the village or near it? What part of New York were you growing up in?
We grew up in Queens, which is a suburb. And then at the age of 13, when I started going to high school, the High School of Music and Art, a very special high school, we'd moved to Manhattan by that time. So at about age 11, I started subway into Greenwich Village on my own for my weekly guitar lesson. And I also was able to, also on my own, my parents were very supportive of my session with music. I was able to take the subway into Greenwich Village for the Sunday hootenannies in Washington Square Park. I'd get off at West 4th Street. So this was sometimes a bus and subway journey that took an hour and a half from Queens. Of course, when we moved to Manhattan, then it was a lot quicker, you know. But I was a citizen of the village even before the age of 12.
So what exactly is a hootenanny? I mean, I've heard the word many times, but conjure up what a hootenanny would be like to be at and experience.
Well, the hootenannies in Washington Square Park were legendary. First of all, Washington Square Park is right smack dab in the middle of Greenwich Village. It's known for that big arch that looks like a smaller version of the Arc de Triomphe. But you enter the park and there's a huge round fountain, and around the fountain, sitting on the edge of the fountain, you know, literally hundreds of musicians with guitars, banjos, dulcimers, harmonicas, basically just singing their hearts out. And you could wander around from group to group and sit in or just take it in, listen. I had my guitar with me in a little cardboard case. Basically, it was just a huge gathering of musicians who liked the same kind of music, which was called folk music. Yeah.
And how old were you when you started playing there?
Well, I wasn't playing publicly for a while. I started playing guitar age 7. That's when I got my first guitar and started getting lessons. But I would be performing by the age of 12, you know. Then I would start daring to show my stuff, yeah.
My guest on Nightlife is Eric Bibb, and you're going to take us on a musical journey too through some of the songs that influenced you. Let's start with Taj Mahal. I know you're a huge fan of blues musician Taj Mahal. When did you first come across his music?
I was about age 16 or maybe 15, and I was in a music theory class in high school, and my friend David Meyer came in with this album called The Natural Blues. N-A-T apostrophe, I think, T-L, Natural Blues. Taj spelled it like that. I was just gobsmacked by this amazingly hip guy who seemed to be breaking all the rules and celebrating and glorifying country blues in such a sophisticated way that I was blown away. You know, here's a guy who was in his early 20s at that point, I guess, basically creating a new genre. He was taking country blues, combining it with kind of modern, at that time, country and soul music elements, and basically bringing to me an awareness of country blues that was just completely new. This wasn't an old guy, you know, who had spent his life farming. This wasn't an old blues veteran who'd spent his life playing in honky-tonks and juke joints. This was a college-educated, you know, African-American who was playing guitar in a unusual way because he was playing a resonator guitar, a steel-bodied guitar, which has a very unique sound. And you hear that sound clunking along with such a good groove, and his partner, Jesse Edwin Davis, comes in, you know, with this amazingly slick electric guitar, which blends with this acoustic guitar so beautifully. It's just so groovy. You know, I was listening to soul music on the radio, and this was like something completely on its own, and I loved it. I loved every minute of Taj, and that particular record just, you know, stayed on my turntable. Yeah.
To kick off Eric Bibb's playlist for you tonight, it's Taj Mahal and Corinna.
Got a bird, what a whistle. Baby got a bird, honey got a bird, we'll sing. Baby got a bird, honey got a bird, we'll sing. Without Corinna, sure don't mean a natural thing.
Eric, Richie Havens is next on the list. Now, Richie was the opening act at the Woodstock Festival. I believe he opened with this song, which is from The Prison. Were you around Woodstock at all?
I was tempted to go, and at the last minute I decided not to because I heard that the traffic was impossible. There were people getting, you know, stuck on the highways for hours, so I decided to skip it. But it was definitely on my radar, and Richie Havens, who did open the festival, I can't say enough about Richie Havens. I followed him around like a puppy dog. I guess I was his unofficial mascot, but I went to every New York gig that I could where Richie was playing, whether he was playing with a duo or trio, to completely on his own. Just Richie and his big Guild guitar, the King of Strum, as he's known, was just somebody who, he thrilled me, yeah.
Okay, so did he know you were there, always watching him? Did you strike up a friendship with him?
That came later. I think I probably ran into Richie in Stockholm sometime during the 70s and made my presence known. But he probably had clocked the fact that, hey, there's that guy again, you know, because I was at every gig that I could be at. And again, Dad was, of course, my first role model as a performer. And then came people like Odetta and Richie Havens and Taj Mahal. But Richie was somebody who was dear to my heart in terms of his sound, just so emotional. He just oozed soul. And the fact that he was, again, a self-accompanying, you know, guitar-playing singer, that worked for me. So I took notes, you know.
Did you ever wish that you just said, down the traffic and gone to Woodstock?
No, I never regretted not being there because, like I said, I'd had a chance to see my favorite performers up close at other venues, you know, in New York, concerts and that kind of thing. You know, I met Bob Dylan in my own living room. Saw Bob Dylan again at a workshop at Newport Folk Festival because I went to the Newport Folk Festival when I was 14 years old. Saw not only Bob Dylan, who bombed out with his group, you know, when he decided to go electric, but I had to leave before they had that performance. But I saw him at workshops. I saw people like Tim Hardin. I saw the great Sun House at that same Newport Folk Festival. So I'd been a fan of all of these people and been to festivals and concerts. So missing out on Woodstock felt like a blessing because it was pretty chaotic.
There you go. You didn't have to deal with the traffic. Here is Richie Havens and this track, which he did indeed open Woodstock with, From the Prison.
It's a window of experience. It's a broken window pane. It's a hurt in the eye where the glass has glanced to be bothered once again.
Tell us a bit about your father, Eric, because not only was he a musician, but he was very much an activist. And as a black child growing up in the era of the civil rights movement, he was very much front and center of all of that, wasn't he?
Yes, both of my parents were active in the civil rights movement. My dad eventually befriended Martin Luther King and was with King and so many others on that famous march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. My dad got involved, I think, in the civil rights movement later on when he befriended my godfather, Paul Robeson. So as a mentor, musically, artistically, but also politically, Paul Robeson was a very important figure in my dad's life and as such became my godparent. My dad was just somebody who, you know, had grown up in the American South in Kentucky, had come to New York to pursue his career as a singer, and had experienced segregation, Southern style, most of his young life. Coming to New York and finding that there was a new world that was not so strictly segregated, that afforded opportunities to befriend people who had been kind of unreachable prior to that, it was life-changing for my dad. So he became active in an integrated movement that was looking for equality and justice. And it was so tied in with the music that people were singing in the folk music world, but my dad was also a musical theater artist. He was a trained singer and met people like John Raitt, Bonnie Raitt's father, who was also a musical theater artist. And circle of friends were, you know, liberal-minded Easterners as opposed to his experience in the South. This was really formative for my dad, yeah.
And with Paul Robeson as your godfather, did you spend a lot of time talking to him? Because, I mean, his own life story was so powerful, and that rise and fall that he had, or not fall, but, you know, the problems that beset him after he had his passport removed. I mean, he went through an awful lot. Did you hear a lot of those stories from him?
Not directly from him. Paul was actually out of the country for quite a bit of my earlier years. But he was a presence in our home, you know, not only his photographs, but my dad would come home with articles that Paul had written. So even though he wasn't around physically, he was definitely a part of my family in that way. I wasn't aware of how famous he was until later on in life and started reading books about him. But proud I was to be able to say Paul Robeson is my godfather, yeah.
So how do you view the role of, or the importance of activism in your songwriting today, Eric?
Thank you for the nice question. I say nice question because I think musicians are in a position to spread certain messages. I think music is a medium that opens up people's minds and hearts in a way that just politics can never accomplish. And I grew up with music that was closely associated with progressive movements, whether it was the labor movement, unionism, or it was civil rights or anti-war activities. All of that was part of the scene that I grew up with. So I didn't really separate ticks as such from music. I just thought that, oh yeah, we can sing our way into a new world. This was me and the rest of my Pete Seeger generation. We believe strongly that music was transformative and that it could unite people. And I experienced that up close. And in later life, I just realized that it was such a part of my core belief system that I just would carry on writing songs that would highlight social issues and talk about those kind of themes. So it's natural for me. It was something that was not even a conscious decision. I just kept going with the roots that established in my childhood.
Well, look, from a serious activism to your teenage years now, we're going to listen to Donovan and Wear Your Love Like Heaven. So take us back to your discovery of Donovan in this song.
Yeah. I was aware of Donovan earlier on, meaning before this record came out, because he was part of that whole tribe of folk musicians, self-accompanying guitar playing, harmonica playing. People thought he was the next Dylan because he played harmonica on a rack like Dylan did. He was a good guitarist, a sweet singer. Catch the Wind was probably the first song that I heard from Donovan. But I followed him, and he evolved into a very interesting, unique, basically pop artist, because he took those folk beginnings and kind of evolved into a more, what can I say, this was the hippie era. So there were a lot of things going on, a lot of experimentation. Recording techniques were expanding and people were able to do all kinds of adventurous things in the studio. And the sound of this record, I just loved. I remember my girlfriend and I at the time just wore this record out because we were, you know, young teenagers interested in finding new horizons, you know, musically, etc. I just thought he was an avant-garde artist who was following his own drummer, and I loved it.
Donovan, Wear Your Love Like Heaven.
Color in sky, brush and blue, scarlet fleece changes hue, crimson ball sinks from view.
With this sort of pedigree, you know, Bob Dylan's in your lounge room when you're seven and growing up with your father as a musician.
11, Eleven.
All right. but with all of that, was there ever any question as to whether you would become a musician or not?
I wasn't thinking so far ahead. I was just basically enjoying an incredibly rich atmosphere of music. Nothing grabbed me as much as music did. It's just, I guess to people around me, it was obvious. I didn't think so far ahead. I was just pretty sure that the best thing to do in life was to sing and play guitar. And I followed that path with a diligence that amazes me sometimes when I look back.
You did go off to university, though. Is this right that you studied Russian?
I did. I studied at Columbia University for the brief time that I was there. I studied Russian and psychology. The reason I decided to take Russian was they wanted to fill up that class. There were not too many people who had signed up for it. I had actually had some experience with Russia because my dad went on a tour of the Soviet Union, as it was called then. In 1964, he was invited by the Cultural Ministry of the Soviet Union to tour for 30 days in the month of August. And he took the whole family on that trip, and we were guests of the Soviet state. They obviously, monitored us and showed us what they wanted us to see. But we were pretty impressed by happening there, where there was international youth camps, kids from all over the world looking all kinds of different ways, playing together. A lot of the people who worked in hospitals in higher positions, doctors, were women. So it was a kind of eye-opening experience to see what was going on as opposed to what we were being indoctrinated with in schools about the Red Scare and all of that kind of stuff. So I saw something that was quite positive. I had a 13th birthday in Kiev, and that was,
Can you still speak any Russian, Eric?
Oh, I don't remember too much at all. I can just say «До свидания». But I haven't been to the Soviet Union since then, or Russia as it's called now. So that was when I was 13 years old, but I'm really glad I had the experience, yeah.
Yeah, incredible. What an incredible life you've had, Eric. So next up on our list, Otis Redding, Ton of Joy. Why is this on your list?
He's a singer whose records dominated my soundtrack when I was a teenager. I heard him on the radio. My mother loved his voice, played his records all the time. What I loved about Otis, and he died so young. I remember my sister coming into my bedroom one morning saying, Otis Redding's dead, you know, the plane had crashed. This was 1967. But his voice, if you hear him on this track, Ton of Joy, he's a Southerner. It's obvious. He's a powerful singer with a kind of rootsy sound. It's just so, so rich. The tune is fantastic, and so is the guitar player, Steve Cropper, and the rest of the band. This just is an exciting tune that really verges on the blues that later became my go-to music genre. But Otis was on that bridge between, you know, pop and soul and blues, and his voice just lit me up.
So, Eric, what was it you think that took you to blues as opposed to folk or soul? What is it about blues that just grabbed you and never let you go?
Oh, that's a good question. And I think it's a question you could ask millions of blues lovers. What is it about this music that makes it so attractive, not only as a listener, but people want to play this music? You know, you can go to a blues festival in Slovenia. You know, there are blues players everywhere you go. So there's something about music that came from a specific place and a specific people under specific circumstances that just is universal. There's something about the triumphant resistance to oppression that you can hear in this music. The people who created this music faced kinds of brutality that we can only imagine. Take it for granted now, but the fact is the music created in a time of segregation and injustice, and the people who were the pioneers of this music on a daily basis were living, you know, in an American apartheid system that was cruel. So for me, I think it's just the way the universe has us the tools to survive some crazy stuff. And I think this music is the tool, whether it's the gospel side of it or the secular side, the blues side, it's all the same music. But there's a power in it that's almost supernatural that has given people hope and courage through, you know, centuries. I can only explain it in that way. There's something bigger than life about this music that connects people. And I can't imagine life without this music. I really can't.
I love that idea that by playing the blues, you're hooking into the stories, though, of all those who developed it and all those who played it before, and the triumphs and the sorrows of everything that they went through as well.
Exactly. And this is why I think that, so I was just going to say, Suzanne, this is why I think it's important for people to be aware of the history of the music and the people who made it, and not just appreciate it on an entertainment level, because you'd be missing a great portion of its richness, you know. So, it goes together with the history of the people.
Eric, next we're going to play Howlin' Wolf, Moaning at Midnight. Tell me about this.
The age of 15, my good friend David Meyer, who supplied me with wonderful LPs during that period. He had a great record collection. He's the one who introduced me to Taj. But he came in one day with an album, Moaning at Midnight, with Howlin' Wolf. This track is like a mantra. It's a one-chord mantra that goes so deep into the Mississippi Delta motherlode. It's just, I don't know, if you had to pick one blues singer of all time, maybe Howlin' Wolf would be the one you'd had to go with. You can hear it. His voice and his harmonica playing.
Howlin' Wolf, Moaning at Midnight. To play J.B. Lenoir next and Alabama March.
Yeah. When I heard this, I was astounded. First of all, it's just one man and a guitar. He has a very unique voice, rather high-pitched, a great singer, and a unique guitar player who plays a bit of a riff in this song that is so astounding harmonically. It almost sounds like bebop music, you know, Charlie Bird Parker or something. It's just a few notes that come in every once in a while, but it's a surprise. But another thing about this song, there were very few blues, country blues artists of his generation from the South who dared directly take on the whole issue of segregation. He did with this song by telling people about this famous march where people were brutalized by law enforcement officers, but they were going to march until they reached the Capitol in Montgomery. And basically celebrating their bravery. And like I said, for a man of his generation to openly, a Southerner, openly talk about these things in a song was very unusual. I love it.
Third month, 25th day of 65. We marched on Alabama. Here. Third, my 25th day.
And now the final song that you'd like to play for us is Mavis Staples and God Is Not Sleeping. Tell me about this song and its importance to you.
I can tell you about Mavis Staples. She's somebody who, from a very early age, my spiritual and musical life beyond description. The Staple Singers were just all over my childhood in terms of the songs that I was listening to. They were on the radio. They were on my record turntable. Staples, great guitar player, great singer, songwriter. I had a chance to meet both Pops and his daughter, Mavis, back in 1997 when we recorded a song for an album of mine in Chicago. So they've been heroes of mine, and Mavis is somebody who's just, she just keeps going. I think she's soon going to be 80-something years old. She's still touring, spreading love, and just a phenomenal human being that you can't forget.
Eric, can I thank you so much for being here on Nightlife tonight, bringing us this array of such amazing music with such powerful messages behind so many of the songs.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
God is not sleeping, no, you got to believe it.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.